Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And I've added to my intro, as you can tell, now that we're getting into, I think, desperate times, I have to start making the point. And most people, you know, there have been elections that have actually swayed and changed because of the impact, the economic impact on your wallet, folks. What I'm trying to say is the debt is fraud. The inflation is real. Everything that they're doing is all a facade. They're stealing your wealth, and they're placing us into dire economic circumstances to collapse America. Now, there's going to be so many people that are going to be running around like chickens with their heads cut off because their dollar is worthless, because the U.S. is basically defrauded on this fraudulent debt. You have to understand, and you have to grab people square on the shoulders and tell them, we do not owe that debt. That debt is illegitimate. You have to start explaining this to your legislators, to your county commissioners, and so forth. There's no authority whatsoever. First off, there's no authority whatsoever for us to be able to go into conservatorship. Nor is the federal government, do they have authority to take on debt for spending money that is illegitimate. This is a game they're playing, and they're playing to win. So, if you're understanding the urgency, because I figure, well, you know, I've been saying it's now or never. I've been saying that for a few years now. So, I've been prompted by a good friend and producer to say, hey, you need to spell it out and give everybody the bottom line, because unfortunately, people really don't start paying attention until you actually point out that this is affecting their bottom line financials. You know, I could also say it's affecting our bottom line spirituality. But there's already enough people running around trying to create theocracies misguiding you over those things. It just seems like, I remember when I was on a very large program that had a lot of different customers. Even though we had one major customer, we supported very specific customers. I don't want to get into the details, but we had, because of these different customers, we had this, it was like stovepipes. We had these different stovepipes of versions of software and systems that we had to support. And it was getting crazy. And as a matter of fact, it actually begged a consolidation by the customer, the ultimate, you know, the top-end customer, the federal government, to basically say, you know, we need to standardize this, which made sense. It made sense, but so many of the decisions they did were actually deplorable and, as far as I'm concerned, unconstitutional and so forth, but that's another story. The point I'm trying to make is that there was a point in time where we were supporting so many different variations that, and all of these different variations, because nobody was managing an overall schedule to ensure that we had, as a program, we had the ability to support all of these different things as they were coming to a head. And I ended up talking with the chief engineer of the program by giving him a graphic, and basically it was a graphic of different train lines all coming into the train station. And I showed how all of these train lines had such close overlap as far as, and actually concurrence on dates when things were coming in the support and so forth. I basically pointed out that what we've been doing with the support that we had when we didn't have this insanity, and now we have this insanity, and I'm trying to get more staff to be able to support this craziness that's being inflicted upon us, and all I'm getting is, you know, talk to the hand. And so, bottom line, creating that graphic actually helped that chief engineer, obtain an epiphany. And it really helped. And as a matter of fact, I wasn't looking to create a dynasty, but it really helped justify the plussing up and the growth of our engineering team to support all of these different things. So anyway, and then down the road, as things started, diverging and so forth, I was always the one advocating, well, we have these engineers that do these unique things. Maybe it'd be better to move them over there, giving up staff, giving up structure, where everybody was happy to gobble it all up. Because you'd think that these leaders I was working with, you'd think that their paycheck was dependent on how many people they controlled. And so that kind of speaks to, whether that person's a manager or whether that person's a leader. And I can tell you in my experience, finding leadership between, business or even in politics is very hard to find. Because getting somebody to take a stand, to do the right thing and to stand up and say, this is wrong, like what I've been doing over the debt, like what we've been doing over all of these things. If you agree that it's time leaders take a stand, then what is keeping you in your seat? What's keeping you from taking a stand and saying all of this is wrong? If you haven't taken the time to read these petitions, then, you're not garnering the constitutional arguments of how all of this stuff is wrong. So I'm just, here kind of poking you, trying to motivate you, trying to help you understand that there is a way out. And that way out, and the weapon we use is not a gun. It's not deadly force. It is the Constitution. We use the law to hold against our public servants who are directly and deliberately violating it, who are actually not just violating it, they're waging warfare against us. I mean, are you grasping this? They're waging warfare that they have no authority to be doing. Anyway, as I've been kind of doing this political exorcism on things that you hear that are evil about the Constitution that is not true. I mean, these are evil spirits that are being raised up by lies and deceit. In other words, they're creating a fear of something that's actually good. Now, actually, I've got to take that back. They're doing that regarding the 14th Amendment, and they're doing that same thing. They're creating fear-mongering with the 16th and the 17th Amendment. The advantage that we've had regarding all of the amendments is not one amendment as has ever given the federal government the authority to, utilize its discretion to rule us. It's not there. It's not in the 16th Amendment, which we already just kind of covered. And it's definitely not in the 17th Amendment, which we're going to try to, put to bed today. But before we do that, before I get back to the political exorcism, because it's Feedback Friday, so I could try to share both sides, moving the ball down the field so that we can, close or, in the game by winning or showing you that we can get this ball across that line. Regarding, without having to be afraid of the 14th Amendment or the 16th Amendment or the 17th Amendment. Now, the most important thing, and this is my feedback, because I got into a very long, I'll just say, and a very animated discussion regarding the regarding the Constitution and constitutional compliance. Now, this individual that I was talking to happened to have a background and was a lawyer, and so their background in law and actually learning classes, via the Constitution. And I will say this, that this is the first lawyer, because I've spoken with a lot of lawyers that have been in the business for a long time. As a matter of fact, I spoke to two lawyers this week. I spoke to one lawyer that actually didn't go to a parochial type of religious school, and one that did. And The one that didn't go to the parochial religious school actually got very little training regarding the Constitution. I mean, none. And, I mean, to any detail. And then the one that went to a parochial school got some. And the interesting thing is that the parochial school actually taught, I consider, very perverse doctrines regarding the Constitution. And what I mean by that is it was disclosed by this one attorney that they were taught in constitutional law that the only legitimate guide for understanding the Constitution is the Federalist Papers. And I'm going, how in the heck? And here's the interesting thing. They were also adamantly taught. In other words, it was strongly insisted upon that the Constitution was not a compact. And so here's the amazing thing. The schools that were actually teaching, we're talking about teaching in the 70s and the 80s. And remember, our education system was hijacked in the 1880s. That's when the communist Fabians came to America and they started picking apart and attacking all of these different aspects of our religion across the spectrum, our law and everything else, which is why we gradually evolved into a communist nation, because they changed our education slowly under our very noses. And I can cover this, and we'll get into this in the petition regarding the education system, because we'll get into the history of all of that. And it's actually in work right now. This is going to be a big one, and so it's going to take a little time to kind of, you know, ferret through. But my point is this, folks. Why was this progressive? Because in the 1970s and the 80s, why was it that these parochial schools were adhering to the old school perversions? I mean, so they started teaching this concept of the Federalist Papers a long time ago. And as a matter of fact, the advocate for the Federalist Papers over the ratification debates was John Marshall. John Marshall, because he actually bore testimony and was a participant in the Virginia ratification debates, he knew how strong those debates were. He knew that if he pointed to, at any point in time, actually provided any justification of the use of the ratification debates, it would take away his ability to usurp and assume powers and actually move this nation towards a larger, more centralized power, towards the federalism, precisely towards the thing that the states rejected in the Constitutional Convention. Now, regardless of which of the two lawyers I spoke with, because, and actually the lawyer that went to the progressive school, or it's a progressive school today. Back in those days, it wasn't. It was kind of a private school. And the lawyer that went to that school, it wasn't parochial, but it was a private school. It was actually a highly regarded school, kind of like UC Berkeley or something like that. So the one that went to that school in the 70s and got their JD, that lawyer, that individual, as they've been reading and as they've been confronted, because he was never taught that the Federalist Papers were the end all. It was what defined the Constitution. But he was taught about a living Constitution, and that rubbed him raw. He knew that the Constitution was never designed to be in this constant flux of being changed and redefined. It was a cement. It was a foundation as a contract. And that's the interesting thing. You know, he wasn't given anything on the Constitution. And basically, you know, other than the fact that it was just this living document. In contrast to the Federalist Paper, I am finding that the lawyers that actually didn't have any type of focus and a deliberate misdirection towards the Federalist Papers are the ones that get it first. Those, and I think it's because of investment, because they were so ignorant that their eyes were far more open to the aha truth. When we look at, and the bottom line is, I'm flabbergasted to hear a lawyer that has an understanding of the Constitution, but called the Constitution anything but a compact. It is not a compact. And I'm hearing this, and I'm going, oh my gosh. You know, when every single framer, lawyers of the time, even Marshall referred to the U.S. Constitution in the ratification debates as a compact. As a matter of fact, all of the framers were looking at this, and as a matter of fact, it was very clear that the point of ratification clarified that the states were the parties in the compact. Thomas Jefferson was very clear. This is why we go through those resolutions of Kentucky and Virginia. But the reason I'm giving you this is because I just found this mind-boggling, how we have people that have built their full foundation on the Federalist Papers that are rejecting the ratification debates. In other words, let me say this, folks. Let's say, because we do know that there was a point in time where Christ traveled, and we look and we have people that are clinging to the scriptures. And there are people that the closer and the harder you entrench yourself into interpreting and getting into a doctrine of the scriptures makes it harder and harder. It's kind of like the person that has built and created this life of comfort in understanding a very specific paradigm. You know, the old adage, it's hard to teach an old dog new tricks. Or it's hard to get an old person to be objective about what they think. And so, scripturally, let's just say that the individual, because I believe Christ traveled, and as a matter of fact, if you've heard the stories or the tales, that Christ actually traveled with the gentleman that gave him his tomb after he was crucified, you know, to put place his body into that tomb. I believe, and I may not be getting the names right or anything else, so I'm going to avoid that, but he traveled around the world a little bit prior to the beginning of his ministry. Now, let's just say he provided prophecy and clarity of what was going to happen and those types of things and what he was going to do. And all of a sudden today, because these writings were written by this one man, who are maybe two or three men, kind of like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, where you get four versions of the life of Christ. But instead of the four full versions of the life of Christ, I'm just hypothetically throwing this out there. What if all of a sudden we get these authentic, you know, finding of these people that were on this travel where they kind of, you know, consolidated their journals and kind of buried them, and we came across them, and there was this full accounting and this unabridged, you know, words of Christ as he traveled with these men. And would people actually reject that? Or would people be open to and looking at and examining, is there a consistency with the word of Christ, of what he was telling these men? I mean, you'll find that there are people that say, we've got the Bible and that is it. And you know, what we've canonized, that's all we accept. We don't accept these other writings of Christ because it was from a different part and we never had it. We never had this. And so my point is, folks, is that we become so blind in our own paradigm that we refuse to accept some other paradigm. And in this legal case or in this paradigm of law, I'm telling you that there are way too many lawyers and there are way too many conservatives that are basing everything that they believe on the Federalist Papers, and they refuse to actually crack open the ratification debates. Why? Because that's a lot of writing. I mean, in contrast to the Federalist Papers, it's almost four times the amount of writing. And the other thing that they don't like is because sometimes you get these people that read the Federalist Papers, they completely avoided the anti-Federalist arguments. One of the things I have learned and have extrapolated, and I hope you're learning this too, is we actually do show some of Mason's writings, some of the things that Mason said, who was an anti-Federalist, some of the things that Henry said, because some of their points that they were making, you know, were little digs, and the explanations were very clear in really defining what that Constitution was. But more importantly, when you get into how they were trying to dismiss very specific parts of the Constitution, like the militia and so forth, you can clearly see that these anti-Federalist assertions were strictly based upon non-compliance. In other words, if the federal government was going to ignore or, you know, no longer utilize the militia, what they're basically saying is that would be a violation of how it was being stated. In other words, the anti-federalists in their own circular logic were actually proving that the Constitution didn't allow those things to happen, but they said they're going to end up doing that. And in ways, Mason was right. The federal government of the states deliberately, and both bodies, states and federal government, started ignoring the militia, and the states didn't hold the federal government accountable, and the states didn't hold each other accountable. They literally marginalized it because why? Nobody wanted to spend money on national defense after the War of 1812. To the tune, other than the Navy and growing in these skirmishes and wars abroad, I mean, that was different, but we didn't need it. The only national defense became this permanent police force of a standing army called the cavalry that was defending and protecting what everybody was okay with. Those were direct violations of the Constitution. What should have happened constitutionally, as soon as a territory was erected, a militia should have been established instead of using a standing army to continually grow and create this professional mercenary force that actually traveled throughout the expanse of the West for decades. It helped justify the Department of Interior and many other egregious violations of federal government taking control of state land and territories, where it was antithetical to how the Constitution was justified. My point is, folks, that the only way we really find out the details of martial law, the details of the militia, the details of our currency, so many details that clarify how what that line in that Constitution really meant, is through the ratification debates. Now, one of the things that the Federalist Papers didn't even cover, I mean, that didn't even scratch the surface, on the admission of new states into the Union and the uniformity standards and some of these things. And so this is why we cover them. And we're getting to a point now, once I finish this exorcism, then I am going to go back through the states that we've covered, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and so forth. And I'm going to go back through those. And I'm going to give you on Feedback Fridays and on Mondays, I'm going to give you additional, because I'm only giving you highlights that we've been using for a while. I'm going to give you additional stuff that is directed towards very specific concepts like the Equal Footing Doctrine, the admissions of states, interposition, those types of things that we really haven't made a point of trying to bring in the other details, or I should say the voices from the dust of our framers and how well they clarified that Constitution. Getting into constitutional compliance, and it can only come from the ratification debates, my friends. It cannot come from the courts. It cannot come from Congress. It cannot come from the Federalist Papers. The Federalist Papers are insightful. I don't hate them. The fact is they're insightful documents, but they're only editorials. The only thing that is legal and legitimate within the compact are the ratification debates. And any lawyer that understands the tenets of contract law, and this is what Madison said, we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
You know, as I was going to say, and that's what happens. I should just really just cut, you know, start cutting bait instead of continuing to try to fish. What I was saying as I was going into break is Madison clarified this several times. He was emphatic in his report on the Virginia resolutions. Now, I want to be clear here. When you read my writings, the only real document that I use that supports lots of tenets. I mean, there's a letter that I use from Madison just to show the consistency of how he supported this concept of the compact and how the compact was defined, how the ratification debates are inseparable. They are inseparable from the Constitution. this actually came up with both lawyers. And I basically said, theoretically. And the interesting thing was the difference in the acceptance. So as I posed this concept between the two lawyers I spoke to this past week, I spoke to one and I said, we would not be in this spot. I said this to both of them, but this is the reply from one of them. But let me tell you what I said. America would not be, and I'm just, you know, I'm not quoting, I am paraphrasing, that America would not be in the dire straits it is today had the original 13 states taken their ratification debates, especially those that debated it, taken their ratification debates and actually tied all of the Federalist definitions and terms and clarifications, every single one of them, and tied them like we do today with footnotes, so that when you went through the Constitution, there would be this one footnote for each clause that would take you to a page and basically consolidate all of the different states' terms and how they defined that clause. Now, first off, I'm going to tell you, because we're going through this and we're proving this every year, that there is no discord, there is no conflict, there's no contradiction. As the Federalists explained the necessary and proper clause, they may have said it differently, but every time they were harmonious. And so the power of that, the consistency of that is incredible. And what should have happened is if all of these states basically did it and then it was consolidated by the federal government, so that whenever any new state, because Congress has the responsibility of admitting new states into the Union, had Congress taken the ratification debates and handed them to each of the new states joining the Union and saying, okay, this is how the Constitution was justified, and this is how each of the states used to clarify, or the Federalists, how it was justified that this is what this clause meant. This is what this meant. This is how we do this. And they provided those contractual terms and definitions to all states joining the Union so that the states would understand how that Constitution was to be interpreted and executed and so forth. We would not be in this mess today. But as they started actually trying to create this
this ambivalence, this you know, this ambiguity regarding the Constitution, that it's kind of this noble document instead of the simplicity of what God gave us. He gave us a compact. And the those who the compact legally belonged to as far as oversight are the sovereigns of the people of the states. Now, that this has become a real point in contention, and this is a point in contention with too many people. We, the people, are sovereigns. I'll never say that we're not. But we establish sovereigns, and the uniqueness of our Constitution is that we recognize the sovereignty of our governments at all levels. In other words, at the state level, our counties are the foundation of our state. At the federal level, the states are the foundation, and we, the people, are the foundation of all three. That's why we have representation at all levels of our government. We have representation by our government as well at the two levels. And if necessary, we should have representation at a third level, where I've talked about this. I've talked several times that when you have counties like Los Angeles County or counties of New York and so forth, where the county is so heavily populated that it is insane to try to, you know, create its own little nation. And this is how democracy is created. And bottom line, the counties themselves need to be broken up into communities. And when I talk about communities, I'm not talking about forcing an integration of a community. When people move to a particular part of town, if it's called Chinatown, then Chinatown should have its own community and should have, you know, their own little governing body that would then have the people's representation as well as the governing body's representation at the county level. If you happen to have, you know, a Hispanic or, you know, different cultures, black, it doesn't matter. It's important that communities have representation. Had we done this, had we continued the spirit of this governing that was based upon the sovereignty in America, the sovereignty being we the people and the governments we institute. Now, throughout the majority of America, the only government that the people would institute would be the county. In these large population centers, there should be a lower level government that the people institute, and that the county becomes an amalgamation of these other governments. But the bottom line is, when we institute a government, we must use a constitution in delegating the specific powers that we want that government to govern us by. We should never give any government ever, and this is the whole point of the Constitution, that we are constitutional republics. We're to use constitutions in delegating defined and specific powers. So, hopefully this little, you know, preamble or this little feedback, hopefully this is helpful. Because bottom line, constitutional compliance is necessary. And the understanding of the ratification debates is immutable. I mean, you can't argue away from this, because the constitutions are compacts, just like a treaty. A treaty is a contract. Unless it's a multi-nation treaty, then it is a compact, just like a power of attorney. And a power of attorney with multiple parties is a compact, whether it's an HOA or whether it is a state or a county or a federal nation. There's a lot of factors. When we really look at government, we do not do ourselves service by teaching that our government is Republican in form only, because we gloss over whether we're a federation or whether we're a confederation. We gloss over all sorts of little aspects that are essential in understanding truly the form of our government. And so bottom line is the between the two acceptances of this, as I was paraphrasing, this concept of the ratification debates being the center of defining the Constitution instead of the courts or instead of some noble body. One lawyer, the lawyer that didn't go to the parochial school, went to the, you know, the state school, or I should say a secular school, and the other one that went to the parochial school disagreed. The one that went to the parochial school said, no, 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 the Federalist Papers, and they wouldn't budge. But the one that actually went to the state school, the secular school, you know, had because they weren't so baked in their bias, they had no problem understanding and accepting, wow, you know, that is a divine concept. That's how God created the governing through Moses of Israel, through the delegation of judges and so forth. What has happened in America is a much more sophisticated and much more much more liberal concept, because it wasn't based on theocracy and the Bible. It was based on the liberty of the person. I would say the man, but the human. Every individual has these rights of liberty. In theocracies or different religions, that could be changed to where the men have these privileges and women have different privileges. But in America, every life, every human has a right of agency to choose for themselves. That has never been available in any theocracy. Never. Even though there may be, you know, these selling points of, oh, well, they, you know, they have these guides or what. I am here to tell you, I believe that the Constitution is the higher law of governing. And we have turned our backs to this higher law of governing. We reject it because of our biases. We reject it for a plethora of reasons. And I am telling you that if we unify on the Constitution and demand full compliance of the Constitution, your problems go away. Geoengineering goes away. Cultural engineering goes away. Social engineering. All of the things and all of the warfare tactics that are being waged against the states and the people will go away. With that, let me try to dive back into, and hopefully we can end this exorcism, because I don't think that there's really much more to go through. The argument that the 16th Amendment, because this is still looming out there, I didn't really close on the 16th Amendment. We kind of ran out of time. I kind of started touching the 17th Amendment, but let's finish on the 16th. The 16th Amendment, there's evidence that it was not properly ratified. We only know, and I know, the only thing I remember, and I don't have the time to read all of this, and the only way to get to the truth is through the audit, through the Republic review process. So this is the point, that even though Oregon, it was identified that Oregon unconstitutionally ratified the 16th Amendment and the 17th Amendment, possibly. I know the 16th Amendment was one of those. And so when we look at Oregon and how that was done, that didn't kill the ratification of that amendment. If you throw out Oregon, the reality is to get to the 36 states, unfortunately, there were six other states other than Oregon that ratified it after that. And so then we had two states that kind of joined the Union after that. So my point is that even if you threw out a state here or a state there, until we actually fully audit so that the state legislature can actually count, you know, cross the T's and dot the I's of ensuring whether what they did was constitutional or not. The bottom line is if the states hold the federal government accountable to the 16th Amendment, then it doesn't allow them, because the 16th Amendment doesn't allow them unbridled spending. It just allows them to tax income. It doesn't allow them to tax income progressively, because it didn't touch the uniformity clause. Taxes must be uniform throughout the union. That has nothing to do with apportionment. That applied to both the duties, it applied to the impost, and it applied to the excise taxes. They must be uniform. It's almost like when they put an excise tax on liquor. Can the federal government create a higher excise tax on gin and tequila or clear liquors like vodka, gin, because it's clear, and then put more taxation on colored? In other words, whiskey, cognac, and those types of liquors that are manufactured in America. Could they actually start creating this, oh, we're going to punish, we're going to tax more heavily for this one than for that one? No. Well, that's the same thing with income. They can't tax disparately. What they tax the poorest person's income to the richest person's income, it has to be uniform. The spirit of uniformity is so ignored and has been completely put aside that most people just complain about the taxation itself. Because it is evil. It is designed to take from those who have and give to those who have not. The framers made sure we were protected from those principles by maintaining uniformity. Anyway, so the 16th Amendment is really just, it's a dead letter. They need to tax one way or the other. We could actually rescind the 16th Amendment. Because there's no reason why they can't go back to actually taxing. But here's the problem. Now that they've closed down, and actually it's really not a problem, because I think it's more of a justification. Because American manufacturers decided to move outside because we shifted from impost to income, which made it a lot more lucrative for U.S. companies to actually manufacture outside the United States, because we're not taxing that stuff anymore. It's a free world. And we've allowed ourselves this ability. And actually, if you look at the Commerce Petition, we even proved that the fact that corporations can go and produce outside the United States, a U.S. corporation or a state, a corporation within a state in the U.S., manufacturing outside cannot get free access if we follow the Constitution. And so the Commerce Clause petition, if you look at the DOC petition, I forget which one it is, maybe 13, maybe 14. It's we have a petition against the Department of Commerce and the way they're operating. Bottom line, if we actually get rid of the 16th Amendment and go back to taxing imposts of goods, because America has become a consuming nation instead of manufacturing, this would force manufacturing to come back. It would force it, because bottom line, we can create a level of impost on all foreign manufacturing that only buying things that are manufactured in the United States. But we have to get the federal government from being able to completely regulate commerce with throughout the United States. They don't have that authority. They can only regulate commerce with throughout the states, among the states, not within the states. The line is they regulate commerce among the states. So states can start creating when a manufacturer sets up, Volkswagen, HP, it doesn't matter if they come back to American soil, and they'll go into those states that become favorable for them, and they will basically flourish or what have you, but they cannot start, you know, jumping into other states. I get it. It creates rust belts and those types of things as the states compete against each other. But it's far better for the states to be competing against each other in a free market that we're supposed to have than allowing them to actually go and economic hostility against America by taking their products and ingenuity that was developed and basically integrated here in America and taking it abroad. The only way America can actually become truly great is if it becomes great once and for all by actually obtaining full compliance of the Constitution. The 16th Amendment can actually be repealed
because, or does it mean that imposts go away? No, the duty tax would be changed. And so as the states actually take their sovereignty back and they take their commercial powers and their economic powers back, then the taxation among the states will be basically apportioned, or going back to the apportionment, where the federal government really doesn't utilize the apportionment as much as they utilize the imposts and excises. Because prior to the 16th Amendment, the majority of the revenue that the federal government made was off of its imposts. Today, we hardly do anything regarding that. The majority of their money is coming from income. In other words, they're coming after us instead of those who are attacking us. Anyway, long story short, I believe that if we obtain constitutional compliance, it will become the red zit on the end of our nose that we just have to get rid of the ability to tax income and go back to apportionment, because that design was divine. Because what it did was it even made it harder for the government to actually go after, you know, individuals. The whole point, if you really read the essence, and I covered this last week, that the 16th Amendment was designed to punish the affluent. The federal government had no authority to do that. States need to do that, and states can do that. If a state wants to become a harbor of affluent people and allow itself to create, you know, this monarchy, you know, like Wyoming could be for sale and become, you know, because the Tetons or whatever, because all this, these stars fly in and flock in and they buy up. I mean, look, that's happening in Montana. It's happening throughout the mountainous states where these people buy hundreds of acres, create a huge mansion, Robert Redford or whomever. And then, you know, what they do is they shield themselves from having to pay local taxes, but they sure, you know, enjoy the advantages of the protection, fire protection, police, and so forth. And I'm going, you got to be kidding me. The reality is states really, and we need to get into this, but what I would recommend is if you really want to start understanding how states need to start protecting themselves from this predatory, you know, Bill Gates mentality of coming in and taking control and creating monarchy, the way we have to do it is we have to get back to republicanism. We have to get back to this fundamental principles, and we actually have to start empowering our government to protect us from too much property grabbing. We want to be, I mean, we'll get into that as we move forward. But bottom line, the 16th Amendment would naturally go away, that America would naturally repeal it, just like the Prohibition Amendment, when we realize that there's no point in having an income tax, and that we could actually unleash the economic engines of every state if we got rid of it and restored the sovereignty in all capacities, commerce and so forth, back to the states. Now, the 17th Amendment. The statehood, or I should say, when we look at the 17th Amendment and the statehood of manufacturing two senators, when a Senate is created, or when a state is created, two senators become a byproduct of that state. Each state is entitled to two senators. The 17th Amendment only changed the mechanism of the choosing of those senators. It does not change, and I, you know, we got about 4.5 minutes, so we'll cover this in the next episode. I apologize. But when we go through the language of the 17th Amendment, it's pretty clear that the language of the 17th Amendment doesn't change the suffrage of of the state legislature in the Senate. And so what I'm trying to tell you, my friends, is when we look at the 17th Amendment, and we read the language, which we'll do right now, since now's a good time, right? So the 17th Amendment, which is, there's the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th Amendment, the language is this. Now, if you show me where it states that the state legislature no longer has any suffrage, that the senators will no longer represent their state legislatures. Now, we just changed the mechanism of how they're appointed. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state, elected by the people thereof for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote. The electors, so it doesn't change the authority, that they get a half a vote or what have you, that they each have one vote. So you have the same equality from the state senators, or I should say the senators in the U.S. Senate in Congress. Each senator has one vote. The electors, or I should say the electorate, the people, the voters in each state shall have the qualification requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. Now, let me ask you this. Why did they throw in the electors in this clause? Because the Senate allocated two electors to the state legislature, and the House of Representatives basically relegated however many seats in the House of Representatives got that many representatives for their electors. In other words, their electors were a federal position that each state got, and those electors were those people, because we cover this to ad nauseum, I think, the electors are those who actually choose the president. So in other words, that didn't change anything. So the fact that they included this, it didn't change the makeup of the Electoral College. Not at all. So the reason they included it was because it was a part of Article 1, not a part of Article 5 or any other part. It was just, okay, we can basically kind of maintain that. It didn't really change it in any substantial way. The next paragraph, when vacancies happen in the representation of any state in the Senate, the executive authority shall issue writs. Instead of having the state legislature, change who becomes the new senator for a temporary purpose because the senator's not there, then the state executive, the governor, does it. Provided that the legislature of any state may empower the executive thereof to make temporary appointments until the people fill the vacancies by the election of the legislature. So in other words, the Constitution took away the power of the state legislature from being able to fill those positions. The reason why this 17th Amendment was necessary was there were states that were refusing, believe it or not, state legislatures were refusing to actually provide a senator to seat them. So the solution was to create a general election for the people to choose the senators so that the state legislatures would have their own representatives, their own representation. Does it state anywhere here where the senators no longer represent the state legislatures? No, it's only talking about the process of appointment. And the last line, this amendment shall not be so construed as to affect the election or term of any senator chosen before it becomes valid as a part of the Constitution. So, in other words, this amendment won't affect those terms until it becomes valid and then at their elections afterwards. So, folks, we'll get back into the 17th Amendment, like I was saying, but we're going to get into Article 5 to help you understand the protection of the state legislature suffrage. I'm J.R. Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.